Okay, I'm here with
Doc Searles.
Doc Searles, and you're a writer for a certain computer magazine?
Yeah, I'm a senior editor for Linux Journal. That either stands for the fact that I'm the oldest editor on the staff, or that some people like to refer to me as senior editor. Huh. So anyway, I'm the senior editor for Linux Journal. I'm also a co-author of the Clutrain Manifesto, which was a website that became a book, which became a bestseller, which became a speaking career, which folds back into the Linux business somehow.
One of the issues that we're looking at, or that's come to my mind by being here, is looking at open source code and proprietary software development that's end-user focused.
Talk.
What's your sense of all of this?
Oh, boy, that's a lot of this. I like what Jamie Zawinski, who's one of the original original Mozilla hackers. In fact, he's the one who named Mozilla, if I'm not mistaken, when he was at Netscape, said, which is, Linux is free if your time has no value, which I think is another angle on what Stig just said about the ease at which, with which anybody can install Linux. I'm not sure exactly what subject we're on right now, because it's not news that Linux is difficult to install. I think that there's the big question is whether or not the open source development model, which is peer review by everybody who's interested, can include the people who are interested in having Linux be easy to install. One of the reasons it's not that easy to install is because the people who use it most don't care. And the people who could use it most are not in a position to, are not in the conversation. Okay, I mean, the first thing that we said in the Clutrain Manifesto is that markets are conversations. One of the things that I've heard a lot since then, mostly from people in the third world, interestingly, is that markets are also relationships. That we tend to, in the first world and in the West, in a developed industrialized world, devalue the relationships that actually do exist between businesses because we employ the vocabulary of exchange. We'll say, well, when it gets down to the bottom line, it's all about shareholder value, which is total bullshit. Nobody's sitting around thinking, I'm just going to do shit for the shareholders. They don't do that. But it's the easy thing for us to do. It's a chant that we say to ourselves. Well, there are, in the same way as this one Nigerian gentleman told me that there are plenty of relationships that happen in business that we don't even see because we're not using the language of relationship. I think there are plenty of relationships in the Linux community and in the open source community that are well known. You know, I think that the nature of relationship is very well understood there. However, and in fact, the nature of exchange is not. I mean, quite oddly, if you take this comes from Eric Raymond, there are three markets have three essential aspects to them. There's exchange, there's conversation, and there's relationship. I think the exchange part of it is diminished, and the relationship part of it is maximized. However, there's not much relationship with the people whose itch you'll need to scratch if the product is going to get easy to install for Joe anybody.
If you want the
happening, and it hasn't been happening for a long time, but that's one thing. I mean that's a very complicated way of talking about one subject we've been talking about here.
Well, I see that it being very important. Someone was speaking of Florida that they use all open source.
Florida,
right?
The state of Florida.
Of Florida. The government officials or the government agencies use Linux-based or open source, and that they actually allocate certain amounts of funds to the development of the process, which brings the marriage of what you're calling exchange and relationship back into focus.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It's in another relatively Republican place. Orange County, I understand, has an awful lot of Linux business going on there. The interesting thing to me here at Linux World is that the conversation has been influenced by free money, and that is the cocaine of the .com phenomenon. You know, an awful lot of people got unsecured loans of colossal amounts of money to manufacture business plans and manufacture products, the single purpose of which is to score on the stock market for your partners and hopefully for yourself as well. That's a very aberrant and odd and I think ultimately epiphenomenal way to do business. I think it's very likely we're going to see it legislated away at some point. I don't know. I wouldn't, maybe not in in the near future, but I think when we have some retrospect on this, I think the fact that there was no risk involved by the people who actually had to do the work was a fundamental flaw with the thing. Anybody could do what the hell they pleased, you know, because the goal was to get a big IPO. Well, Linux was turned out to have been a lot more infected by that than a lot of other dot-com areas were, and it's a tragic thing. And we're at the end of that. I mean, there are, you know, the last of the dot-coms are either making it or not making it as we speak.
My sense, I felt a lot like it's 1982 when we had, you know, instead of having 15 different kinds of laptop or, you know, PC mm-hmm. computers, all of a sudden we have a whole lot of...
We had K-Pro and we had Osborne and all those other guys, and those guys are going down. Well, there's a similar thing going on now, I think. But a larger concern that I have is that for the net itself. And this has only shown up for me in the last couple of days. I'd be very interested to hear what Stig thinks about it. I'm inherently an optimist, and I think that the nature of the internet is in fact to route around problems. It's just to see problems as opportunities and route around them. However, you have to get to people to be able to do that, and you can get a lot more routing when there's a lot more bandwidth involved. But the people who are in fact providing the bandwidth, the people who are delivering the bandwidth, which are cable companies and phone companies and entertainment companies, never wanted to be in this business in the first place. And as the dot-com guys, like Excited Home, which has 4 million customers, including myself, I'm very accustomed to getting 2 megabytes down and a 0.5 megabyte up and putting servers on that thing and being a wide bandwidth participant in the internet for $19.95 a month or whatever the heck it is, maybe $39 at the most. It's a very good chance that that company, which owes like $1 billion to these guys and those guys, is going to go out of business. And, you know, AT&T and these other guys are not stepping forward to suck up that debt. They're going to wait for those guys to go Chapter 11 and screw their customers in the process. What I'm seeing happening with 802.11 right now, I mean, I paid $59 to MobileStar in order to connect by 802.11, that's wireless, at Starbucks. For the next month. That's a lot of money. That's, you know, it's going to be a lot of stuff for Starbucks. Starbucks not even involved in it. But the way that the pricing is set up looks a lot to me like buying a phone card or sitting there and being metered on the phone system. Very similar. Very similar. So I'm a little bit depressed about what's happening on the last mile or the last acre or the last whatever it is, because it's the people who have always seen business in terms of distribution, delivering services, for example, rather than relationship, rather than something symmetrical, that are going to be in charge of this thing. You know? And the net runs on that. So I'm a little concerned about that. I don't know if other people share that or not. It's just a recent observation, like starting last night.
You know, back to the other issue with the different kinds of end-user interfaces that are proprietary versus all the open source. It's become a big intersection with a whole lot of people in it at the same time, and which way do we go from here?
Well, let me just say a little bit about that. We have this assumption that there's this continuum that has proprietary at one end and open at the other. My friend Craig Burton, who was on a panel I had this morning, says we collapse two different distinctions there. The opposite of open is closed. The opposite of proprietary is public domain. Linux is proprietary, okay? Linux is owned to a significant extent by Linus Torvalds. There's not going to be code that goes in there that Linus Torvalds doesn't approve of. That's significant. Now, he happens to be a very generous guy. The GPL is involved, a lot of other stuff like that. However, it's very accessible. Linux is very accessible. But that's an open-closed issue. It's very open, but it's also to some degree owned. The fact that companies like Apple and Microsoft, and for that matter Zimian, have relationships with customers, they care about providing a useful and easy experience for those customers. What we need is some kind of a, you know, what we need is for, maybe if I look at it, put it this way, I think there is in around the issue of building infrastructure for everybody, an economics of altruism that we all have that my Nigerian friend called attention to, where we do stuff for us and we draw a much bigger circle about who the hell us is, so that, you know, the everyday user is somebody who's itch. The hacker who works entirely in a command line world wants to scratch because he sees them as part of the same picture, rather than just, well, I don't need that shit, so I'm not going to care about it. I don't know. Then sort of rambling around here, but they're, I was pretty astonished that Napster had something like 60 million users, all sharing music with each other. It was not the easiest thing in the world to use. It was pretty easy to use. You had to have a computer to use it, okay? But a lot of people, everyday folks, a lot of women, a lot of girls, I mean, an awful lot of the names on that thing were female names. An awful lot of the record collections that were on there were women. They weren't it was closer to the mainstream than almost anything that has happened since the PC came out. Probably at least as much as AOL, for example, okay? The record companies came along and squashed that sucker flat, and no cries went up. That's astonishing to me. It makes me even more cynical than I want to be. I'm an optimistic person, but also I'm a bit of a linguist, there are conceptual metaphors that do our thinking and talking for us. For example, I thought it was very interesting that I used to be a writer and suddenly I'm a content provider. Where the hell did this word content come from? The .com guys started using content. It only came up in about 95 rather. I mean, nobody made content before. Nobody called editorial matter content. Nobody called a movie content. Nobody called newspaper work content. Now we have chief content officers. What's that about? You know, why do we have officers, you know, chief marketing officers, like, sir, yes, sir. Like, ordinary bureaucrats need epaulettes on their uniforms, you know. And there's a sudden, what's behind that? Well, part of it is something we barely brought up in Clutrain, but is a significant thing, which is that ever since industry won the Industrial Revolution, which it did, before which our surnames had meanings, if your name was Baker or Miller or Smith, you know, there's a good chance you had an ancestor or maybe even your dad did that. You know, was a coppersmith or a tanner or whatever. We had crafts that we brought to the marketplace. The marketplace is a real place. The word market meant one thing. It was like a bazaar, which I think the open source guys did a brilliant job of reminding the world of. But when once industry won the Industrial Revolution and once industrialization got well underway, we developed a vocabulary for describing business that was thick with the language of shipping. So we have content that we load or move through a channel to an end user or a consumer who is so far down that chain, this vast delta of value chains that fan out from first sources to final customers, that we can now objectify the human beings that define and call them consumers, which my friend Jerry Mikulski, who's coming out with a book about this later this year, calls a gullet who lives only to gulp products and crap cash. And we suffer that. We actually think that a consumer is an okay thing. I believe consumerism is, in fact, producerism. I think, you know, that it's not a popular phenomenon. I think it's a popular acquiescence to something that's so deeply embedded in our conceptualization of business as shipping that we barely question it. That when the shipping system that feels threatened by a sharing system that predates it by, you know, that worked for 10,000 years and got kind of flattened 200 years ago, shows up and essentially finds a way to route around what happened to commercial broadcasting, which is that it became so totally corporatized and so deeply in violation of the things that annoyed us 40 years ago when payola came along. Three disc jockeys took records to play something on the air. Well, now whole, you know, I mean, it's so vertically integrated now that everything you hear on the radio goes straight from Sony out to the out through the radio stations. Well, Napster was a workaround of that. It was a popular workaround of that. But there wasn't enough, there wasn't a deep enough consciousness about how much that was a throwback to the Enlightenment that began 200 years ago and got shut off by the industrial system that grew.
I would make a quick comment. I work with high school kids in a little bit of radio work, and I was amazed at their computer skills just because they had learned Napster. And my opinion of Napster was that it's the single most important educational tool that was ever developed to teach people how to use a computer. And it's phenomenal to me that Napster wasn't congratulated and actually put on a pedestal for their ability to educate large masses of people about the function and use of a computer.
That could be a problem with Napster, unfortunately, is that it was developed for Windows, and the entire hacker community was not part of it, even though, you know, the guy was a hacker in the first place. And Eric Raymond, bless his heart, he's a good friend of mine, you know, reamed, what's his name, who's the guy who did Napster? I'm trying to remember his name. I can't remember it offhand. I should. But just like, you know, just dismissed him as a punk. But the kid did an incredible hack. It's an incredible piece of work. And it was a wonderful thing for the culture. I fell in love with music again. I had forgotten how much I loved music until Napster came along. I had the greatest time with that. I'm 54 years old, by the way, so I've been around a lot of music for a long time. I replaced my entire record collection with other people's records, you know. And I went and I ripped every single one of my CDs and I put them on there, and I bought more CDs than I ever had before. It got me excited about music. And yet even I acquiesced. It's like I knew it was going to end, and so, yeah, so it ended. I think we're at the I don't think we have I don't think there is an alternative sensibility. Not even, actually, that's the wrong way to put it. We don't have the conceptual metaphors of sharing like we did 300 years ago, like we do in the third world, that are deeply embedded in what markets are all about.
And
one of the nice things that, there's a really good book called In the Beginning Was the Command Line by Neal Stephenson, who also wrote Snow Crash and the rest of them. You could read it in one sitting. It's only about 60,000 words.
It's on cryptonomicon.com. You can just download it from there.
Yeah, there. If you look it up on the web, the organization of it on cryptonomicon.com is not as good as some others have organized it as a more searchable, as a one big long searchable file, which is great. But one of the things that Neil does in that is compare Unix to the Gilgamesh epic. In other words, it's a story that gets retold many times and in many different ways. Anybody properly motivated can write yet another version of Unix, and it will have the same virtues and the same mythologies, and in many ways tell the same stories in different ways. And so that's, and I highly advise reading that. It's a very, very good book. It's not the most optimistic for those of us who would like a pretty desktop at the end of it. His conclusion is sort of like, cope with it. You know, it's hard to use.
I wanted to go back a little bit about to the three points that you had mentioned earlier, relationship, and what
conversation and exchange as three, the way Eric described it, there are three. You could sort of see the architecture of an abstraction of an architecture of a market as three layers. The bottom layer is exchange. You have to have exchange, and sitting on top of that is conversation, and on top of that is relationship. So,
and where are we? Like, it seems like we have a couple different issues here. We have the Microsoft kind of model, and we have the open code, open source, and then we have the proprietary issues of the end user that are, and how do we sort of make sense of where we're going with what we got and what's going to happen?
I'm not sure that particular construct helps a lot. I think it's an interesting abstraction. I think we make a mistake if we assume that Microsoft does not have relationships with its markets, however. Microsoft has a very powerful relationship with an awful lot of everyday developers who have no religion about open source or closed source or whatever. They're just trying to get some business done, and it's huge. And there are plenty of people, you know. I mean, I rent space down in Southern California from an ISP. They're almost entirely a Microsoft shop. Most of their customers are Microsoft customers. They like using Microsoft Exchange. They like the fact that now they can get Windows 2000 and it's more reliable. There's no other universe for them in many ways. And that's not necessarily, I mean, I can call it a bad thing from outside their framework. But from inside of it, they're not seeing a problem. Okay, and they have a relationship with Microsoft. They have a Microsoft-involved relationship with their customers. And this is invisible to a lot of us in the open source world, where there is so much contempt for Microsoft that we miss the marketing 101 that they do, which frankly does involve talking a great deal with an awful lot of people. There's an interesting story that bears telling here. In 1996, I was at a small conference of people who got together. Actually, I met Chris Locke, who's my co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto there. It's the first place where I vetted the idea that markets are conversations. The guy putting out was Jerry Mikulski, who talked about how consumers are gullets and all that. And among the people there were a gentleman from Microsoft and a gentleman from Apple, who I'll leave nameless because they may or may not agree with exactly my recollection of what they said, but this is pretty darn close. So I talked about how not only how markets are conversations and I was sort of vetting that idea, but I also thought it was interesting that you drop that a problem with the market conversation of media, of commercial media, especially broadcasting, is that the customers and the consumers are two different populations. In other words, the people who pay for advertising and are not the people who watch the advertising. You and I watching NBC have zero influence on that market conversation. We are just consumers, okay? Now, but if we go down to Walmart and we buy something, we're both customers and consumers. There's a big difference. It's a huge difference. And so the moderating influence of the people actually watching advertising is missing from that particular conversation. So I said, well, we've got this conversation going on up here, and then we have another conversation that's not happening down here, and I think that the web goes into the middle of that and disintermediates a lot of the media, and it's a problem. The advertising business, the commercial broadcasting business, is one that's conducted between, on the one side, networks and radio stations and TV stations and their agencies, and on the other side, the advertisers. Okay? Those are the people having that conversation. The money goes from the advertisers to the media by way of their agencies. Okay. And if you look at the word balloon that's happening over that, it's all about avails and runs and roadblocks and messages and impact and 30 and 60 second blocks and all that kind of stuff. Okay? The people receiving this, the consumers of it, pay nothing. They are not involved. They do not participate in that market conversation, except very, very indirectly. Only their money participates if they go ahead and buy the advertiser's product. It's very inefficient. You know, mass market advertising is very expensive and extremely inefficient. You don't know who you're reaching. One of the myths of advertising, and I used to run an advertising agency for many years, one of the myths of it is this old saying that I know that half of my money is wasted, I just don't know which half. That's bullshit. 98% of it is wasted. Maybe 99% of it is wasted. And you know how much it is. You know, it's very, very inefficient. In the meantime, the web shows up, and now you know any of these companies that are now advertising can have direct relationships with their customers, with the customers they're now paying very inefficient media for reaching in a relatively insulting way. Which is somebody who said, well, geez, in the computer industry, do we have any companies that are actually in conversation with their with their customers. I mean, because they said, I can't think of any. And it so happened that the week before, Microsoft had created like 150 Usenet news groups for the single purpose of creating venues where customers or anybody could talk about their products. There's one for every one of their products. Unmoderated. Just to put it out there. And a lot of people are coming in saying, oh, this is a Microsoft PR thing and so forth. And Microsoft individuals are coming in and saying, no, we want to know what you're thinking. We created this place so anybody could say what the hell they please. So, and I mentioned this. I said, I think there actually is a company out there that is somewhat conversational. I think it's Microsoft. And I think we have a controlled study going on here, which is that this company is at least trying to do that. And I'm pretty sure some of the others are not, because they're too busy telling their customers what their customers want. So, and afterwards, so this guy from Microsoft came up to me. He said, you know, that's really odd. That's the first time I heard it's credited with Marketing 101. That's what they teach you in school, you know. Find what the customer wants and give it to them. The customers want to be able to talk about our stuff, so we created that. And he said, as a matter of fact, we do this to such a fault, it's ridiculous. He said, Word and Excel are full of enhancements that exactly one customer asked for. He said, that's part of the rolling bloatware. He said, we make our products much too big because we listen too much to what people say. And that shows up in the products. So a few minutes later, I run into this Apple guy. He says, you know, it's kind of funny because at Apple we hate our customers. We don't want any contact with our customers. We want to scrape them off on resellers and VARs and intermediaries of all kinds. We want to tell our customers what they want. And we so revere our own engineers and their wisdom that we isolate them from customer feedback to the extent that a tech support group in Austin, Texas actually like chartered a plane and flew themselves out to Cupertino one day to lay a bill of particulars on Spindler, who was running the company at that time, saying, will you please get engineering to fix these? So is it any surprise who kind of won that one? You know, but that was an example of a company that we all hate, essentially, you know, versus a company that a lot of us love because they make nice art, which is what Apple's about, actually. You know, doing essentially a better job of being a conversational company, you know, than the other one. And I think, by the way, that, I mean, a lot of people in the open source movement are just very contemptuous of what Craig Mundy is doing by talking about shared source. I think it's brilliant what they're doing with shared source.
And what do you mean by shared source?
Shared source is Microsoft's addition to the open source conversation. And while in the hand, some of their licensing particulars essentially infect you if you ever look at it and don't want to do anything with it. We'll ignore that for a second. But what they're doing is saying, let's draw a circle around everybody who's interested in this product. Our customers are on one side, we're on the other side. We'll share our source with those guys, and we'll let them help us develop this because we're both interested in it. That's, now, Eric calls that gated source. But that, whether or not you can criticize that, that appeals to a lot of corporate customers, especially the ones that are used to only dealing with Microsoft. They'll say, well, great, we would like to influence how Windows evolves. We would like to influence how Office evolves. If, you know, if they're willing to share some sources, we'll help them hack that. You know, that's in our interest to do that. Now, that's not compliant with open source wisdom. However, it is something that appeals to those customers. Yeah, I'm Doc Searle, senior editor with Linux Journal.